In 2003, the first transgenic pet was offered for sale to the public, a red fluorescing zebrafish. It was created by Dr. Jinwan Gong in Singapore and licensed to a company in Austin, Texas. It was marketed under the name Glowfish after 2 years of review by federal and state agencies, which concluded the fish were safe as long as they were not eaten.
Madame Bond, the first grade teacher said, your son is a delightful boy, but he is having trouble with his math. Addition comes slowly to him. Subtraction is even more difficult. However, his French is much improved.
I'm glad to know that, Gail Bond said. The move here from London was hard for him, but I must admit I'm surprised about his difficulty with math.
Because you are a scientist, you mean?
I suppose so, yes. I work at the Institut National here in Paris, she said, and Evan's father is an investment banker. He works all day with numbers.
Well, the teacher replied, as you are a geneticist, I am sure you know everything is not in the genes. Sometimes the child of a great artist cannot draw. But I must tell you that it does your son no good if you do his homework for him.
Sorry, Gail Bond said. Do his homework?
Well, this must be the case, the teacher said. You or someone else in the household.
I don't understand.
Evan's homework is always perfect, but when there is a quiz in class, he does poorly. Evidently, someone is doing his homework for him.
Gail Bond shook her head. But I don't know who it could be, she said. My son comes home from school, and only the housekeeper is there when he does his homework. She doesn't speak much French. I return at 5, and by then his homework is finished, or so he tells me.
You do not review it?
No, never. He says there is no need.
Well, the teacher said, he is getting help from somewhere.
She took out the homework sheets and spread them on the desk.
You see? Every problem on every sheet perfect.
I see, Gail said, staring at the papers. And these stains. There were small green and white stains on the paper, droplets.
Often these marks are present, usually at the bottom of the sheet, as if something were spilled.
I think I know who is helping him, Gail Bond said.
Who?
It's someone from the lab. She unlocked the door to the apartment and heard Gerard call,
Hello, sweetheart,
exactly as her husband did. Hi, Gerard, she said. What's new with you?
I need a bath.
I'll see that you get one, she said. She walked into the hallway where Gerard was standing on his perch. He was a transgenic African gray parrot, now 2 years old. While he was a chick, he had received a variety of human genes, so far with no noticeable effect.
You look good, baby. I've missed you,
Gerard said, again imitating her husband's voice. Thank you, she said. I have a question for you, Gerard.
Okay, if you insist.
Tell me, what is the answer to 13 minus 7?
I don't know.
She hesitated. What is the answer to 13 take away 7?
That was how Evan would phrase it.
Promptly, the bird said, 6.
11 take away 4? 7.
12 take away 2?
10.
She frowned.
24 take away 11?
Oh, 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 the parrot said, moving on the perch.
You try to trick me.
13.
What's 101 take away 70?
31, but we never get so many numbers. Most is 2 numbers.
We?
Gerard said nothing. He ducked his head rhythmically. He began to sing, I love a parade.
Gerard,
Gail said, does Evan ask you for help?
Oh, sure.
And then a perfect imitation of Evan.
Hey, Jerry, come and help me. It's too hard for me.
Then a whine.
It's too hard.
Gail said, I have to get the video camera.
Am I a star? Am I a star?
Yes, she said, you are a star.
He spoke in an American drawl. We're sorry we're late, but we had to pick up our son, Hank.
What movie is that? She said, the same drawl.
Now, Joe, just take it easy.
You're not going to tell me, are you?
She said.
I need a bath, Gerard said, before any filming. You promised me a bath.
Gail Bond hurried off to get the camera.
During his first year of life, Gerard showed little effect from the human trans genes that had been injected into him as a chick by Yoshi Tamizu and Gail Bond in the laboratory of Maurice Grolier at the Institut National in Paris. This was not surprising. The successful injection of trans genes was a tricky business and required dozens, even hundreds of attempts before it worked properly. That was because multiple conditions had to be fulfilled for the gene to work in a new environment. First, the gene had to be incorporated correctly into the existing genetic material of the animal. Sometimes a new gene was incorporated backward, which had a negative effect, or none at all. Sometimes it was inserted into an unstable region of the genome and triggered lethal cancer in the animal. That was rather common. Furthermore, transgenics was never a matter of inserting a single gene. Researchers also had to insert the associated genes necessary for the primary gene to function. For example, most genes had insulators and promoters. The promoters might make proteins that switch off the animal's own genes to allow the new addition to take over, or they might enhance the workings of the injected gene itself. The insulators kept the new gene separated from the genes around it. They also made sure the new genetic material remained available within the cell. Complex as they were, these considerations didn't take into account the further intricacies that might arise from messenger RNAs within the cell, or from the genes that controlled translation, and so on. In reality, the task of injecting a gene into an animal and making it work more closely resembled debugging a computer program than it did any biological process. You had to keep fixing the errors, making adjustments, eliminating unwanted effects until you got the thing working. And then you had to wait for downstream effects to show up, sometimes years later. That was why the lab felt that Gail Bond should take Gerard home and keep him as a pet for a while, to see if any positive or untoward effects showed up. Home rearing was especially important because African greys were highly intelligent, generally considered as intelligent as chimpanzees, and with a far greater capacity for language. Using sign language or computer keyboards, a few non-human primates had mastered about 150 words, but that was merely average for a grey parrot. Some grey parrots had as many as 1,000 words, so they needed the kind of interaction and stimulation found in a human environment. They couldn't be left in an animal holding facility around mice and hamsters, or they would go mad from lack of stimulation. Indeed, animal activists believe that many grey parrot pets were mentally disturbed as a result of insufficient interaction. It was as if they had been held in solitary confinement year after year. A grey parrot required at least as much interaction as a human being. More, some scientists argued. Gerard was finger-trained as a chick and began talking early. He already had quite a vocabulary when Gail, who was 31 and married to an investment banker, brought him home to her apartment. As Gerard came into the living room, he said,
Hey, nice place, Gail. Way to go.
He had unfortunately picked up bits of American slang from watching television at the lab.
I'm glad you like it, Gerard, she said.
I was just saying that, the parrot said.
You mean you don't like it?
I mean I was just saying that.
Okay.
Just an observation.
Right. Fine.
She immediately made notations in a logbook. Gerard's speech might prove highly significant.
One of the goals of the transgenic experiment was to see to what extent scientists could modify the intelligent behavior of non-human animals. Primates were off limits, too many rules and regulations, but people weren't so sensitive about parrots. There were no ethics committees to supervise parrot experimentation, so the Grow Your Lab worked with African greys. Among the things they were looking for was evidence of self-awareness in the parrot's speech. Parrots were known to be self-aware. They recognized themselves in mirrors, but speech was different. Parrots did not reliably use the word I when referring to themselves. Generally, when they used the personal pronoun, it was to quote someone else. The question was whether a transgenic parrot would ever use the word I unambiguously, and it seemed to Gail Bond that Gerard had just done exactly that. It was a good start. Her husband Richard showed little interest in the new arrival. His sole reaction was to shrug and say, "Don't look for me to clean that cage." Gail said she would not. Her son was more enthusiastic. Evan immediately began to play with Gerard, putting him on his finger and later on his shoulder. As the weeks went by, it was Evan who spent time with the bird, who bonded with it, who kept it on his shoulder much of the time, and it seemed who got help from the bird. Gail set up the video camera on a tripod, adjusted the frame, and turned the camera on. Some gray parrots were able to count, and there were claims that some had a rudimentary understanding of the concept of zero, but none was able to do arithmetic. Except Gerard. She had to work very hard to conceal her excitement. "Gerard," she said in her calmest voice, "I am going to show you a picture, and I want you to tell me what it says." She showed him one sheet from her son's homework, folding it to reveal a single problem. She covered the answer with her thumb. "I did that already." "But what does this say?" Gail asked, pointing to the problem. It was 15 minus 7. "You have to say it." "Can you look at this paper and tell me the answer?" she said. "You have to say it," Gerard repeated. He was hopping from one leg to the other on his perch, getting irritable. He kept glancing at the camera. Gerard didn't like to be embarrassed. Gail said, "It says 15 take away 7. 8, the parrot replied at once. Gail resisted the temptation to turn to the camera and shriek with delight. Instead, she calmly turned the page to reveal another problem. "Now, what is 23 take away 9?
14.
"Very good. And now..."
"You promised me," Gerard said.
"I promised you?"
"Yes, you promised me," he said. "You know." He meant the bath.
"I'll do that later," she said.
"For now, you promised me," sulky tone, "my bath."
"Gerard, I am going to show you this next problem and ask you, what is 29 take away 8?
"I hope they are watching," he said in an odd voice. "They'll see. They'll see and they'll know and they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly."
"Gerard, now please pay attention. What is 29 take away 8? Gerard opened his mouth. The front doorbell rang. Gail was close enough to the bird to know that Gerard himself had made the sound. He could imitate all sorts of sounds perfectly. Doorbells, phone rings, toilet flushes. "Gerard, please..." The sound of footsteps, a click, and a creak as the front door opened.
"You look good, baby. I've missed you," Gerard said, imitating her husband's voice.
"Gerard," she began, a woman's voice.
"Oh, Richard, it's been so long."
Silence. Sound of kissing. Gail froze, watching Gerard. The parrot continued, his beak hardly moving. He was like a tape recorder. The woman's voice,
"Are we alone?"
"Yes," her husband said. "Kid doesn't come back until 3.
"And what about,
"Gail is at a conference in Geneva."
"Oh, so we have all day."
"Oh,
God!
More kissing. Two pairs of footsteps crossing the room. Her husband. You want something to drink?
Maybe later, baby. Right now, all I want is you.
Gail turned and switched the video off. Gerard said, Now will you give me my bath? She glared at him. The bedroom door slammed shut, creaking of the bedsprings. A woman squealing, laughing, more creaking springs. Stop it, Gerard, Gail said.
I knew you would want to know, he said.
I hate that fucking bird, her husband said later that night. They were in the bedroom.
That's not the point, she said. You'll do what you want, Richard, but not in my house, not in our bed.
She had already changed the sheets, but even so, she didn't want to sit on the bed or go near it. She was standing on the other side of the room by the window, Paris traffic outside.
It was just that one time, he said.
She hated it when he lied to her.
When I was in Geneva, she said. Do you want me to ask Gerard if there were other times?
No. Leave the bird out of it.
There were other times, she said.
What do you want me to say, Gail?
I'm sorry, all right?
I'm sorry.
I don't want you to say anything, she said.
I want you not to do it again. I want you to keep your fucking women out of this house.
Right. Fine. I will do that.
Can we drop it now?
Yes, she said. We can drop it now.
I hate that fucking bird.
She walked out of the room.
If you touch him, she said, I'll kill you.
Where are you going?
Out. She met Yoshi Tamizu at his apartment. They had begun their affair a year before and had resumed it again in Geneva. Yoshi had a wife and child in Tokyo, and he would be returning there in the fall, so it was just a friendship with privileges.
You feel tense, he said, stroking her back.
He had wonderful hands.
Did you argue with Richard?
Not really. A bit. She looked at the moonlight coming in through the window, surprisingly bright.
Then what is it?
Yoshi asked.
I'm worried about Gerard.
Why?
Richard hates him. Really hates him.
Oh, he wouldn't do anything. It's such a valuable animal.
He might, she said. She sat up in bed. Maybe I should go back.
Yoshi shrugged.
If you think. I'm sorry, she said.
He kissed her lightly.
Do what you think is best.
Gail sighed.
You're right, she said.
I'm being silly. She slid back down under the covers.
Tell me I'm being silly. Please.
Brad Gordon clicked off the TV and yelled, It's open! Come in! It was noon. He was lounging in his third-floor apartment in Sherman Oaks, watching the ball game and waiting for the pizza delivery guy. But to his surprise, the door opened and in walked the best-looking woman he had ever seen in his life. She had elegance written all over her. 30-ish, tall, slim, European clothing, heels that were not too high. Sexy, but in control. Brad sat forward in his lounger chair and ran his hand over his chin, feeling the stubble.
I'm sorry, he said. I didn't expect any visitors.
Your uncle, Mr. Watson, sent me,
the woman said, walking directly toward him. He hastened to stand.
My name is Maria Gonzalez.
She had a slight accent, but it didn't sound Spanish, more German.
I'm involved with the firm that does your uncle's investment work, she said, shaking his hand.
Brad nodded, inhaling her light perfume. He wasn't surprised to hear she worked for Uncle Jack. The old guy surrounded himself with good-looking, extremely competent businesswomen. He said, What can I do for you, Ms. Gonzalez?
Nothing for me,
she answered smoothly, looking around the apartment for a place to sit. She decided to remain standing.
But you can do something for your uncle.
Well, sure. Anything.
I don't need to remind you that your uncle has paid your bail and will be assuming the cost of your legal defense. Since the charge involves sex with a minor, the defense will be difficult.
But I was set up.
She raised her hand. It's none of my affair. The point is this. Your uncle has helped you many times over the years. Now he needs your help, confidentially, in return.
Uncle Jack needs my help?
He does.
Okay, sure.
In strict confidence.
Right, yes.
You will discuss this with no one, ever.
Right, understood.
Word of this must never get out. If it did, you would lose your legal defense funding. You'd spend 20 years in prison as a child molester. You know what that means?
Yes. He wiped his hands on his trousers. I understand.
No screw-ups this time, Brad.
Okay, okay. Just tell me what you want me to do.
Your favorite company, Biogen, is about to announce an important new discovery, a gene that cures drug addiction. It's the first step toward a huge commercial product, and it will attract a lot of financing. Your uncle currently holds a large position in the company, and he does not want his position diluted by additional investors. He wants them scared off.
Yes?
By some bad news coming out of Biogen.
What kind of bad news?
At the moment, Maria Gonzalez said, Biogen's most important commercial product consists of a cell line, the Burnett line, which the company bought from UCLA. The cell line produces cytokines, important in cancer treatment.
Yeah.
Contamination of those cell lines would be disastrous. She reached into her purse and brought out a small plastic bottle of a well-known brand of eye drops. The bottle contained clear liquid. She unscrewed the cap and put a single drop of liquid on the tip of each finger of her other hand. Got it?
Yes, he said.
One drop on each finger. Let it dry.
Okay.
Go into Biogen. Your swipe cards still work. Check the database for storage locations and research lockers containing the Burnett line. The storage number is on this card. She handed him a small card with the number BGOX617-8990QD. There are frozen samples, and there are live in vitro incubators. You go to each one and just touch them.
Just touch them? Brad looked at the bottle. What is that stuff?
Nothing that will hurt you, but the cells won't like it.
The security cameras will record me. Card swipes are recorded. They'll know who did it.
Not if you go between 1 and 2 a.m. The systems are down for backup.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are. This week only.
Brad took the plastic bottle from her and turned it over in his hand. You realize, he said, they have off-site storage for that cell line, too.
Just do what your uncle asks, she said, and leave the rest to him.
She closed her purse.
And one final thing. Do not call or contact your uncle about this or any other matter. He wants no record of any contact with you. Clear?
Clear.
Good luck. And on behalf of your uncle, thank you.
She shook his hand again and left. No blonde extinction after all. BBC reported false story, absent fact check. No WHO study, no German study, a bad blonde joke for 150 years. The World Health Organization, WHO, today denied it had ever conducted or published any study predicting the extinction of the blonde-haired gene. According to the UN group spokesman, WHO has no knowledge of how these news reports originated, but would like to stress that we have no opinion on the future existence of blondes. According to the Washington Post, The BBC story stemmed from a German wire service account. That story, in turn, was based on an article published 2 years before in the German women's magazine Allegra, which cited a WHO anthropologist as its source, but no record of the anthropologist exists. The story would never have run, said Georgetown media professor Len Euler, if even minimal fact-checking had been done by BBC editors. Some media observers noted that news organizations no longer check anything. We just publish the press release and move on, one reporter observed. Another reporter, speaking on condition of anonymity, said, let's face it, it's a good story. Accuracy would kill it. Further inquiry by the urban legend site Snopes.com uncovered multiple versions of the extinct blonde story going back 150 years to the time of Abraham Lincoln. In every instance, scientific validity was claimed to bolster the story's credibility. A typical example dates from 1906. Blondes doomed to vanish from Earth. Major Woodruff sounds their death knell. It's science. The girl with the golden tresses is doomed, and within 600 years, blondes will be extinct. The fate of the blonde was foretold today by Major C.E. Woodruff in a lecture at the Association for the Advancement of Science at Columbia University. Clearly, blondes will not become extinct, but neither will the news stories that predict their demise, since the stories have been repeated for a century and a half with no basis whatsoever, said Professor Euler. Henry Kendall's wife, Lynn, designed websites for a living, so she was usually at home during the day. Around 3 in the afternoon, she got an odd call. This is Dr. Marty Roberts at Long Beach Memorial, a voice said. Is Henry there? He's at a soccer game, she said. Can I take a message? I called his office, and I called his cell, but there was no answer. Dr. Roberts' tone made it sound urgent. I'll see Henry in an hour, Lynn said. Is he all right, Dr. Roberts? Oh, sure, he's fine. He's perfectly fine. Just ask him to call me, would you? Lynn said she would. Later, when Henry came home, she went into the kitchen, where he was getting cookies and milk for their 8-year-old son, Jamie. Lynn said, Do you know somebody at Long Beach Memorial Hospital? Henry blinked. Did he call? This afternoon. Who is he? He's a friend of mine from school. A pathologist. What did he say? Nothing. He wanted you to call him back. She somehow managed not to ask her husband what it was all about. Okay, he said. Thanks. She saw Henry glance at the phone in the kitchen, then turn on his heel and walk into the little study that they both shared. He closed the door. She heard him speaking softly on the phone. She couldn't make out the words. Jamie was eating his snack. Tracy, their 13-year-old, was playing her music very loud upstairs. Lynn yelled up the stairway, A little less noise, please! Tracy didn't hear her. There was nothing to do but go upstairs and tell her. When she came back down, Henry was in the living room, pacing. I have to take a trip, he said. Okay, where? I have to go to Bethesda. Something at the NIH? The National Institutes of Health were in Bethesda. Henry went there a couple of times a year for conferences. Yes. She watched him pace. Henry, she said, are you going to tell me what this is about? I just have some research. I just have to check on something. I'm not sure. You have to go to Bethesda, but you're not sure why? Well, of course I'm sure. It's to do with Bellarmino. Robert Bellarmino was the head of genetics at NIH and no friend of her husband. What about him? I have to, deal with something he has done. She sat down in a chair. Henry, she said, I love you, but I am really confused here. Why aren't you telling me? Look, he said, I don't want to talk about it. I just have to go back there. That's all. Just for a day. Are you in trouble? I said I don't want to talk about it, Lynn. I have to go back.
Okay. When?
Tomorrow.
She nodded slowly. All right. Do you want me to book?
I've already done it. I have it handled.
He stopped pacing and went over to her. Look, he said, I don't want you to worry. That's pretty hard, under the circumstances.
It's fine, he said. It's just something I have to take care of, and then it'll be taken care of.
And that was all he would say. Lynn had been married to Henry for 15 years. They had 2 children together. She knew better than anyone that Henry was prone to nervous tics and flights of fancy. The same imaginative leaps that made him such a good researcher also made him a bit of a hysteric. He was inclined to frequent self-diagnoses of dreaded diseases. He visited his doctor every couple of weeks and telephoned more often than that. He was plagued by aches, itches, rashes, and sudden fears that woke him in the middle of the night. He dramatized small concerns. A minor accident was a brush with death, the way Henry told it. So even though his behavior about a trip to Bethesda was odd, she was inclined to regard it as probably minor. She glanced at her watch and decided it was time to defrost the spaghetti sauce for dinner. She didn't want Jamie eating too many cookies or it would spoil his appetite. Tracy had turned her music up louder again. In short, daily events took over and pushed Henry and his odd trip from her mind. She had other things to do, and she did them. Henry Kendall left Dulles Airport and drove north on 267, heading toward the primate facility in Lambertville. It was almost an hour before he saw the chain-link fence and the guardhouse behind the double gates. Beyond the gates, he saw huge maple trees that obscured the complex of buildings farther back. Lambertville was one of the largest primate research facilities in the world, but the National Institutes did not publicize that fact or its location, partly because primate research was so politically charged and partly out of concern for vandalism by activists. Henry pulled up at the outer gate, pushed the button, and said, "Henry Kendall," and gave his code number. He hadn't been there for 4 years, but the code was still good. He leaned out of the car so the camera could see his face clearly. "Thank you, Dr. Kendall." The gate opened. He pulled through to the second gate. The first closed behind him. A guard came out and checked his ID. He vaguely remembered the guy. "Didn't expect you today, Dr. Kendall." He handed him a temporary swipe card. "They want me to clear some things out from my storage locker." "Yeah, I'll bet. Things are getting tighter around here since, you know..."
"Yeah, I know."
He meant Bellarmino. The inner gate opened and Henry drove through. He passed the admin building and went straight to the holding facilities. The chimps were formerly in Building B. He assumed they still were. He opened the outer door and swiped his card on the inner door. He went down a corridor to the B monitor room. It was a room filled with display screens, showing all the chimpanzees on 2 floors of the facility. There were about 80 animals of various ages and sexes. The on-duty veterinary assistant was there, in khaki uniform, but also there was Rovac, the head of the facility. He must have been notified by the front gate. Rovac was 50, steel-gray hair, military bearing, but he was a good scientist.
"I wondered when you'd show up," Rovac said.
He shook hands. He seemed friendly.
"You got the blood?"
"Yes," Henry nodded.
"Fucking Bellarmino had a cow," Rovac said. "He hasn't been out here yet, and we think we know why."
"What do you mean?" Henry said.
"Let's take a walk," Rovac said.
Henry consulted his paper.
"I'm looking for female F-402.
"No,"
Rovac said.
"You're looking for the offspring of female F-402. He's this way."
They started down a side corridor. This led to a small training facility that was used for short-term teaching experiments with animals.
"You keep him here?"
"Have to. You'll see."
They came into the training facility. At first glance, it looked like a kindergarten playroom. Brightly colored toys scattered around, blue carpet on the floor.
A casual visitor might not notice that the toys were all made of high-impact, durable plastic. There were observation glass walls on one side. Mozart was playing over the speakers.
"Likes Mozart," Rovac said, shrugging.
They went into a smaller room off to the side. A shaft of sunlight came down from the ceiling. There was a 5x5 cage in the center. Inside sat a young chimpanzee, about the size of a 4-year-old child. The chimp's face was flatter than usual, and the skin was pale, but it was clearly a chimp.
"Hello, Dave," Rovac said.
"Hello,"
the chimp said. His voice was raspy. He turned to Henry.
"Are you my mother?"
he said. Henry Kendall could not speak. His jaw moved, but no words came out. Rovac said,
"Yes, he is, Dave."
He turned to Kendall.
"His name is Dave."
The chimp was staring at Henry, just staring silently, sitting there in the cage, holding his toes in his fingers.
"I know it's a shock," Rovac said. "Think how people here felt when they found out. Vet almost passed out. Nobody had any idea he was different until out of the blue he came up negative on a sialic acid test. They repeated it because they assumed it was an error. But it wasn't an error. And then he started talking about 3 months ago."
Henry sighed.
"He speaks well," Rovac said. "Has a little trouble with verb tenses, but nobody has been instructing him. In fact, he's been kept away from everybody around here. You want to let him out?"
Kendall hesitated.
"Is he,
Chimps could be nasty and aggressive. Even small ones might be dangerous.
"Oh, sure, he's very docile. He's not a chimp, right?"
He opened the cage.
"Come on out, Dave."
Dave came out hesitantly, like a man released from jail. He seemed frightened to be outside the cage. He looked at Henry.
"Am I going to live with you?"
"I don't know," Henry said.
"I don't like the cage."
He reached out and took Henry's hand.
"Can we go play?"
They went into the playroom. Dave led. Henry said,
"Is this his routine?"
"Right. He gets about an hour a day, mostly with the vet, sometimes me."
Dave went over to the toys and began to arrange them into shapes, a circle, then a square.
"I'm glad you came to see him," Rovac said. "I think it's important."
"What's going to happen to him?"
"What do you think?" "This is illegal as shit, Henry. A transgender higher primate. You know, Hitler tried to cross a human and a chimp, and Stalin tried. You might say they defined the field. Let's see, Hitler, Stalin, and now an American researcher at the NIH? No way, my friend."
"So what are you..."
"This represents an unauthorized experiment. It has to be terminated."
"Are you kidding?"
"You're in Washington," Rovac said, "and you're looking at political dynamite. NIH funding is already flat from the current administration. It'd be cut to a tenth if word of this got out."
"But this animal is extraordinary," Henry said.
"But unauthorized, that's all anybody cares about." Rovac shook his head. "Don't get sentimental. You have a transgenic experiment that was never authorized, and the rules state explicitly that any experiment not approved by the boards will be terminated, and there will be no exceptions."
"What will you,
"Morphine drip intravenously. Won't feel a thing," Rovac said. "You don't need to worry. We'll take good care of him. And after incineration, there will be no evidence at all that it ever happened."
He nodded to Dave.
"Why don't you go play with him for a while? He'd like the company. He's bored with all of us."
They played a sort of impromptu game of checkers, using toy blocks, jumping over each other while they both sat on the floor. Henry noticed details. Dave's hands, which were the proportion of human hands, his feet, which were prehensile like a chimp's, his eyes, which had flecks of blue, and his smile, which was not quite human,
not quite ape-like.
This is fun, Dave said.
That's because you were winning. Henry didn't really understand the rules, but he thought he should let Dave win. That's what he had done with his own kids.
And then he thought, this is my own kid.
He wasn't thinking clearly. He knew that. He was acting by instinct. He was aware of watching intently as Dave was returned to his cage, of the way he was locked in with a key press padlock, of the way...
Let me shake his hand again, Henry said. Open it up again.
Look, Rovac said, don't do this to yourself or him.
I just want to shake his hand.
Rovac sighed, unlocked the lock. Henry watched. 01, 05, 04. He shook Dave's hand and said goodbye.
Are you coming tomorrow?
Dave said. Soon, Henry said. Dave turned away, not looking at him as Henry left the room and closed the door.
Listen, Rovac said, you ought to be grateful you're not being prosecuted and thrown into jail. Now don't be foolish about this. We'll handle it. You go on about your business.
Okay, Henry said. Thank you.
He asked to stay at the facility until it was time for his plane home. They put him in a room with a terminal for researchers. He spent the afternoon reading about Dave and all the annotations in his file. He printed the entire file out. He walked around the facility, went to the bathroom several times so that the guards would be accustomed to seeing him on the monitors. Rovac went home at 4, stopping in to say goodbye on his way out. The vets and guards changed shifts at 6. At 5:30 p.m., Henry went back into the training facility and headed straight for Dave's room. He unlocked the cage.
Hello, Mother,
Dave said.
Hi, Dave. Would you like to take a trip?
Yes, Dave said.
Okay. Do exactly what I say.
Researchers frequently walked with the tamer chimps, sometimes holding their hands. Henry walked with Dave down the training corridor, moving at a casual pace, ignoring the cameras. They turned left into the main corridor and headed for the exterior door. He swiped the inner door, led Dave through, and opened the outer door. As he expected, there were no alarms. The Lambertville facility had been designed to keep intruders out and to keep animals from escaping, but not to prevent researchers from removing animals. Indeed, for a variety of reasons, researchers sometimes needed to remove animals without going through extensive red tape. And so it was that Henry put Dave on the floor of the back seat of his car and drove to the exit gate. It was now shift change, with a lot of cars coming and going. Henry turned in his swipe card and his badge. The guard on duty said, "Thanks, Dr. Kendall." And Henry drove out into the rolling green hills of western Maryland.
You're driving back, Lynn said. Why?
It's a long story.
Why, Henry?
I have no choice. I have to drive.
Henry, she said, you're behaving very strangely. You know that.
It was a moral issue.
What moral issue?
I have a responsibility.
What responsibility? God damn it, Henry.
Honey, he said, it's a long story.
You said that.
Believe me, I want to tell you everything, he said. I really do. But it'll have to wait until I get home.
Dave said, is that your mother?
Lynn said,
who's in the car with you?
Nobody.
Who was talking? That raspy voice.
I really can't explain it, he said. You'll just have to wait until I get home, and then you'll understand.
Henry,
gotta go, Lynn. Love to the kids. He hung up.
Dave was watching him with patient eyes.
Was that your mother?
No. Somebody else.
Is she angry?
No, no.
Are you hungry, Dave? Soon.
Okay. We'll find a drive-in.
But meantime, you have to wear your seatbelt.
Dave looked puzzled. Henry pulled over and clipped the seatbelt around him. It didn't really fit. He was only slightly larger than a child.
I don't like it.
He started to tug at the harness. You have to wear it.
No.
Sorry.
I want to go back.
Can't go back, Dave. Dave stopped struggling. He stared out the window.
It's dark.
Henry ran his hand over the animal's head, feeling the short fur. He could feel Dave relax when he did it.
It's okay, Dave.
Everything is going to be fine now. Henry pulled back onto the road and headed west.
What are you talking about?
Lynn Kendall said, staring at Dave, who sat quietly on the living room couch.
This monkey is your son?
Well, not exactly.
Not exactly?
She paced around the living room.
What the hell does that mean, Henry?
It had been a normal Saturday afternoon. Their teenage daughter, Tracy, was in the backyard, sunbathing and talking on the telephone and not doing her homework. Her brother, Jamie, was splashing in the wading pool. Lynn had spent the day inside the house, finishing a job on a tight deadline. She'd been working hard on it for the last 3 days, so she was surprised when she opened the front door and her husband had walked in, leading a chimpanzee by the hand.
Henry, is he your son or not?
He is, in a way.
In a way. That's clear. I'm glad you cleared that up.
She spun, glared at him. An awful thought occurred to her.
Wait a minute.
Wait just a minute. Are you trying to tell me that you had sex with a...
No, no,
her husband said, holding up his hands. No, honey. Nothing like that. It was just an experiment.
Just an experiment? Jesus, an experiment? What kind of experiment, Henry?
The monkey sat curled up, holding his toes in his hand, looking up at the two adults.
Try to keep your voice down, Henry said. You're upsetting him.
I'm upsetting him. I'm upsetting him? He's a fucking monkey, Henry!
Ape.
Ape, monkey, Henry, what is he doing here? Why is he in our house?
Well, I'm not... Actually, he's come to live with us.
He's come to live with us. Out of the blue.
You have a monkey son, and you never knew about it. He just suddenly arrives with you.
Great. That makes sense. That makes perfect sense. Anybody can understand that. Why didn't you tell me, Henry?
Oh, never mind. Let it be a surprise. I'm driving home with my monkey son, but I'll tell you about it when I walk in the door.
That's great, Henry. I'm glad we had all those therapy sessions about intimacy and communications.
Lynn, I'm sorry.
You're always sorry, Henry.
What are you going to do with him? Are you going to take him to the zoo or what?
I don't like the zoo.
Dave said, speaking for the first time.
I didn't ask you,
Lynn said.
You keep out of this.
And then she froze. She turned. She stared.
He talks.
Yes,
Dave said.
Are you my mother?